It's a romantic dream for a lot of people, getting away from the hard surfaces and hard people in city life and moving to the country. But people who only know city or suburban life can be a little out of their element in the country, to say the least. So what do you do to make sure you're taking proper care of the land? One answer is to get training as a land steward. Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center, SOREC, offers a land steward program so people who want to be good stewards can learn how. We have three people with us to talk about the program on The Exchange. Rachel Whirling is the land steward coordinator at SOREC. Good to have you back on The Exchange, Rachel.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
Clint Nichols is with us as well. He's with the Jackson County Soil and Water Conservation District and a rural planner. Is that the essence of it?
Yep. Thanks.
All right. And Diane Choplin is with us. She's a rural property owner and a graduate of the land steward program, apparently from the first class 7 years ago. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you.
So, Rachel, let's start with you. Was it originally for people who wanted to learn how to farm, or what was the general genesis for the land steward program?
Well, at OSU Extension, we have programs that serve a lot of different needs. Like, we have a woodland manager program and master gardener programs. This program is kind of an overall, it really gets to how people view themselves as kind of a landowner that have a bunch of land contacts on the property they own. And also it's important to reach the private landowners, because as you may know, in this area we have the checkerboard of public and private land and lots of private people living next to wildlands. And so getting good management techniques next to where the government is also working on having good management techniques.
Yes, the nice square lines of the BLM land because of the original railroad land grants made more than a century ago.
Right.
Interesting stuff in Southern Oregon. Let's move on to Clint Nichols, and thank you for joining us. What's the first thing most people want to know about protecting or enhancing their land?
Probably water. That's probably one of the biggest questions that I get asked a lot is, I'll do a site visit and they either have irrigation and they want to know how to use it wisely or efficiently, or they want to get water rights and they want to know what that process is like. We have a lot of people coming up from California, and Californians know all too well the limitations that water brings to what you can do with your property. So it's a big topic for me.
Well, particularly in the area of trying to get water rights, what are some of the answers you can provide there?
It's really kind of hard. There are some areas here in Jackson County where there are still some water rights available, thanks to things like the Lost Creek Dam, the Applegate Dam. But in most other places, it's just not available. So.
All right. So if you don't have water rights connected to your land at the beginning, you're not going to be able to get more than the land is allotted at the moment.
Yeah, there's some exceptions, but you got to work with the water master. You got to work with your local irrigation districts to try and get that squared away if you can. So,
Diane Choplin, let's get your story. You moved here from where?
From San Francisco, one of those California immigrants.
From the city itself?
From the city itself.
Wow. So what was the push to get you out into the country, as if there didn't need to be one in any big city, I guess?
Well, San Francisco was a great place to live, but I feel that, I guess, for a strange twist of words, I'd outgrown it. I wanted more space. And I was pregnant at the time and wanted to move up and raise my son on a farm. So it was really exciting change. It was as far as learning curves are concerned, I describe it as a vertical learning curve, so really not a curve at all.
Just straight up.
I didn't grow up on a farm, but I served in the Peace Corps, and so I knew what it was like to basically be outside for much of the time, and I definitely had romantic notions of what it would be like. And, of course, the romance is there, but it's also a lot of hard work.
Had you picked up any knowledge of land stewardship specifically in Peace Corps?
Not so much. I mean, it was arid lands. I was in the Sahel, but I suppose if I tag team on what Clint had to say about water, it certainly gives you some interesting perspective on what you do with a little bit of water.
So did hands go to head pretty quickly after you got on the land and went, oh my God, what have I done here?
Well, the timing was actually really great. I moved up here. It was the end of May. The land steward program starts pretty soon thereafter in the fall. And so I had signed up for that first inaugural program in 2009. And I'm often teased for having the youngest land steward because my son was born almost before I'd completed the class and attended the last four classes with me as a newborn. So I just dove right in.
Wow, he really is he got on the ground floor of the program.
He did.
What were some of the particular complications that you ran into in adapting from urban life to rural? I mean, what were some of the real specific kinds of things that you went, oh my God, I have no idea how to do X?
Well, we have a creek that runs through our property, and having a riparian zone is a lot of responsibility. I would like to know that the water that leaves the property after it's been on it is cleaner than it was when it came on it. We have a lot of tailwater that comes from flood irrigation from neighbors and whatnot. And so really understanding how to manage that and manage it well. And then wildlife. I mean, in San Francisco, certainly there is wildlife, but not big wildlife like we have out here. So knowing how best to set up having livestock, chickens and sheep, et cetera, but also doing that in a way that we can protect our livestock but not impinge negatively on the wildlife around us. So,
what's the big wildlife you're talking about?
Well, for us, coyotes, and recently larger wildlife, a wolf.
Really?
Wolf predation is not common, but it's something that, you know, people are starting to become more aware of.
Where's your land?
I live on East Valley View Road on the other side of the freeway.
Okay. So not up all in the Grizzly Peak Range where there was some recent predation. Or was that you?
Well, that was our area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. So, Rachel Whirling, back to you. It sounds like there are new challenges in land stewardship all the time, things like new kinds of predators moving into the region.
Yeah. We have an upcoming class this winter. We'll be having a wildlife biologist talking about living with large predators as well. Not part of the training program, but part of our ongoing class offerings.
What then was the genesis? I mean, I was asking as you came in here because I just sort of worked on the assumption that there's a land steward program in southwestern Oregon. There's probably one elsewhere in the state, but it sounds like there's not.
Yeah, this is the only one of its kind, and it's unique. Extension has a lot of these different kinds of programs, but this program, you know, one of the things that we've started saying about the land steward program is that it's a gateway program. Like there's, as we know in our area, there are a lot of with Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. There's a lot of forestry outreach, a lot of wildfire concern. But when we do evaluations of land stewards as they're coming in and what their concerns are, what kind of land they own, like types of land, they mostly own forest, but they don't really think of themselves as forest managers. They think of themselves and their concerns are much broader. It's not like 90% of my concerns are wildfire. It's like I'm concerned about wildfire and water and trees and wildlife habitat. They have this really broad range. So this program really gets to that for folks.
We will talk about some of the other facets of the Land Steward Program offered through the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center, which we love to call SOREC. Rachel Whirling and Diane Choplin and Clint Nichols, our guests on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with them and take phone calls and emails from you. You may have many if you live in rural areas and have it for long. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Rachel, Clint, Diane, and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Land Steward Program provided by OSU Extension in Jackson County through the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center, which teaches people who own land and want to be good stewards of that land how to do that. And the Land Steward Program goes on for 11 weeks starting in the fall. I understand there's some registration deadline coming up soon. We'll get to Rachel Whirling to tell us about that. She is the Land Steward Coordinator at SOREC. Clint Nichols is with Jackson County Soil and Water Conservation District. He's a rural planner and therefore one of the trainers in the program. And Diane Choplin owns rural property in Jackson County and is one of the first graduates of the Land Steward Program several years ago. Questions, comments, ideas. Maybe you have gotten onto your own rural land and are a little up in the air about what to do with it. Here's the place to ask the questions, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Just in general terms, and I guess I'll pitch this one to Clint. I mean, we talked about water rights already. Beyond that, what are some of the things that people would like to do with their land, and they really don't have much of a clue how to start?
So I probably get a couple of different directions. Because I can do site visits for anybody in Jackson County, I get a lot of different questions. One of the bigger ones is what to do with pasture land. You know, I've got cows or sheep or goats or whatever, how best to manage my pasture. Weeds is always a big topic that comes up with that. You know, I'll get site visits to landowners who want to talk more about wildlife habitat, oak habitat restoration, those sorts of things. So it can really be kind of a lot of different things. It seems like every week it's something different, so...
Well, regardless of what their issue is, when you do a site visit, is it generally going to be sort of a whole look at what some of the options are there?
It depends on the property owner. Some landowners, they know exactly what they want to do. I want to move away from flood irrigation. So then the conversation goes straight to, okay, well, here's your options for pressurized irrigation systems. Other people, it's, I've had my property for a month and I have no idea what to do here. And I'm like, okay, well, let's start around the house and then we'll move out from there. You know, we'll start with your goals. What are your goals for your property? What do you want to do here? And then we move on from there.
I want to ask Rachel about this. What are some of the first mistakes people often make? I mean, what are some of the common questions that you get for the people who are just registering for the program?
Well, I think, I mean, I've kind of been in fields, related fields, for a long time, and it's when people move from the city and they've lived all their life in the city, you can't make assumptions about what you understand about house streams. It might be high water, high winter water, a perfectly normal thing, and they might be really concerned about it, kind of what a forest should look like, how thick it is, or wildlife coming in. One thing like dead trees is a big thing. People often think that a dead tree is a bad thing, whereas for wildlife, of course, it's really positive. It's often providing habitat. So there are a lot of assumptions that folks make if they don't have experience.
Are people still thinking in terms of like fences that they'd have in urban and suburban areas where they're trying to keep certain things out when in the country things tend to circulate around quite a bit, don't they, Clint?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we talk to landowners about a lot is, you know, if you have, you know, if you're going to put a fence in a forest, you should think about, you know, designing that fence in a way that's going to allow deer or other animals to pass through them, because if not, one, it's dangerous for the animals, but two, that's a big maintenance cost that you're going to be incurring because that fence is going to come down every year.
In some cases, the people move to the country with this great dream of what they'd like to do with the land, but their land is really not the best for it. They haven't chosen well just because they kind of lack knowledge just in the purchase part of the equation.
Yeah, unfortunately, that happens a lot. I've come across some landowners who, you know, they bought a piece of property, and then I have to be the one to kind of break the news to them that, well, you probably don't have water rights, or maybe you don't have enough water to really do kind of what you want to do, which is one of the things I think that's really nice about the LandServe program. We've actually had landowners who have taken the class, and they, at the beginning of the class, we asked landowners to tell us, you know, what kind of land do you own? They say, well, I own 0.1 acres in Medford because I haven't bought my rural land yet. And so that's a great starting point. If you come in and you haven't purchased your rural land, this class teaches you what to look for.
So nobody comes in and buys north-facing slopes and decides they want a vineyard or something like that?
Right.
Got it. So, but you went ahead and bought your land before you moved here. Is that right, Diane Choplin?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And were there any issues right off the bat with it that made it perhaps unsuitable for things you thought about?
Well, I have to admit, I was kind of concerned first and foremost about being a new mom because of the timing. That was a big thing in and of itself. But, you know, the leach field needed to be replaced, a status of a leach field if you're living on land.
For your septic system?
Yeah, a septic system. That's a really big thing to take a look at. Water rights, as Clint mentioned, are another. It's helpful to take the program before you buy the land because there are certain weeds and things that are really hard to get rid of. And without knowing what they are, you're not really sure what you've got.
What's the toughest one?
Well,
which one?
There's quite a list. Yeah. I myself had a lot of blackberry, which if I think about all the different weeds that I've tackled and some of the ones my neighbors have had versus, say, poison oak or something like that, I would take blackberry over poison oak any day. But I also am trying to avoid using herbicides and pesticides on my land, so some are a lot easier to get rid of without those things than others, although blackberry I would not say is particularly an easy one, but it's not going to give you hives while you're trying to get rid of it. Medusa head is another big one for folks on dry land that's really hard to get rid of. And unfortunately, some of the techniques that are used to get rid of these weeds, including fire, we're not allowed to necessarily just open burn with a torch. It's really hard to do that as a private landowner, although that's a strategy that would work really well for some weeds.
We're talking about the Land Steward Program offered through the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center with Diane Choplin, who took the program, Clint Nichols, who's a rural planner with the Jackson County Soil and Water Conservation District, and Rachel Werling, who's the Land Steward Coordinator at SOREC. 11 weeks, that's a lot of training. What do you pack in that time, Rachel? Is it a day a week for 8 hours or something?
Yeah, so it's from 12 to 5 on Wednesdays, and it's starting in September. The class itself starts in September, and I can just run you down kind of the topics. There's wildfire, there's woodland forest health, there's natural vegetation and wildlife, kind of habitat, streams and riparian areas, pastures, soils and organic waste, small acreage systems and infrastructure, things like septic tanks or water catchment, that kind of thing. A little piece on economics and enterprise, and then about stewardship planning as well. So it really is an overview of many topics that then you can go deeper into, and we connect you with resources, we connect you with agencies, folks like Clint at Soil and Water or Oregon Department of Forestry, people who can help you kind of tackle your specific interests, and maybe even, if you're lucky, connect you with funds to do things you want.
It sounds like a lot of different tools here, everything from spreadsheets to Pulaskis in this program.
Yeah.
essentially.
Yeah.
Well, and if I can jump in here, that was one of the most important experiences for me. As somebody who was new to the area, I didn't really know what the possibilities were for resources. And it was through taking the land steward program that I learned about, at the time, Soil and Water called it the LAP, the Landowner Assistance Program. Now I think it's just called District Funds. Is that right, Clint?
Conservation Assistance Program.
Ah, so. Okay. We changed it again.
Again, yes.
The name's changed, but the same great service is there. And basically, it's an opportunity to apply for a grant for funds up to a certain amount and no more than 50% of the cost of the program. But it allowed me to do a very big riparian restoration for the creek that runs through my property, which is something I could have never done on my own.
How much creek frontage do you have there?
Well, it's about 500 feet, running feet.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have a setback on either side of the creek. So it actually covers quite a bit. And previously, it was pretty much taken over with blackberry brambles. There wasn't a whole lot of the creek that you could see. And now we've planted a lot of native plants. We see a lot more birds that come in, and birds that are unusual for the area are nesting on our property now, like orioles. So it's pretty exciting.
Wow. So what kinds of plants did you put in there that make it more like it would have been before the blackberries took over?
Well, yeah, and the whole native conversation, of course, can get very sticky. But what I did do is I went with some fabulous recommendations from both Soil and Water and also Loma Katsi, which is a
program. Restoration project. Yep.
Exactly. And they specialize in riparian areas. And then Plant Oregon is a great source of information and also for plants. So we planted a lot of snowberry, ninebark, dogwood, willows. We also planted alders and ash. Thimbleberry. There's a whole list that they can provide you. And because I had a small child, I was concerned about not picking any plants that would have poisonous berries. But, you know, there are many, many options for plants. Quite a long list.
How did you manage to absorb all the stuff from the 11 weeks of classes when you were having a baby, what, two-thirds of the way through the program? I mean, I can imagine.
Well, I won't know what I didn't absorb, right? Well, the great thing about the program is that you can continue once you've taken the program and graduated. If I wanted to, I could attend classes in the current session that's going to run, and it doesn't cost me a thing. I just show up with my land steward badge. I can go to any class for free with the current trainings that they're doing. So if there's something you missed or your priorities have changed or kind of as you learn more, you realize what you still need to learn, you can go in and fill in the blanks. It's really great.
Clint and or Rachel, I understand from and Diane gave us a little sketch here about the grant that she had access to, but it sounds like there's a number of grants available to rural landowners for certain kinds of things, among them wildfire preparation or clearing of land, creating defensive spaces around houses, those sorts of things.
Sure, yeah. So there's the small grant program that that my district has. Oregon Department of Forestry has some funds available for defensible space around the home. There's the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, which is now the All Hands, All Lands Resiliency Project. I'm not sure what the total term for that is.
Name?
Yeah, they basically broadened the scope. So before it was really just restricted to sort of the Ashland watershed, and now it's bigger than that. It's actually sort of its strategic areas kind of in and around the Ashland area over into the Wagner Creek on the kind of sort of talent side. So there's some funds available there for some real thinning, which is kind of in the back 40, clearing out some of your forest there. You know, and then there's other sources of funding too. If you have some stream frontage, there's Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board that has some funds available to do stream restoration in key salmon habitat areas. So there is some funding that's available out there. You just got to kind of get plugged into the right people, and you got to have a plan. You got to be able to show people what you want to do.
So Diane, you mentioned birds. Are there any fish in that stream? Is it a fish-bearing stream?
Actually, no. We have crawdads and frogs, but not a lot of fish. And that would be an interesting possibility to explore. I also have a pond that when I bought it was an illegal pond. And so I brought it into compliance with a second grant, actually, with Soil and Water. So I've had two so far. And my eventual hope is that maybe sometime down the road I can get a third one, wink, wink, to continue to work on the pond and make it an ecosystem that can support some fish. And my understanding is that if it drains to the creek, which it does, that complicates things. So it would be working with Fish and Wildlife to figure out what the options are.
Was the pond illegal because it was not an
it was unpermitted.
No, okay, so no permit for the impoundment itself, but
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so you got the permit for that. Grab your headphones because I want to invite listeners to give us some calls. We have some already. We are talking about the Land Steward Program available through the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center in Jackson County. Rachel Werling is the Land Steward Coordinator of the program. Clint Nichols is the Rural Planner at the Jackson Soil and Water and Conservation District. And Diane Choplin is one of the land stewards herself. She is a rural property owner and one of the original graduates of the program back in 2009. You can join us on the exchange with questions about your own land and what to do with it, or questions about the program itself. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you have some stories to share, like Diane's. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Deanie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a question about rural property and fire liability. We are carrying a big insurance for fire that might be set by, who knows, hunters, campers, you know, people wander off and can touch on our property, particularly during hunting season. And so I was just wondering, what are the owner liabilities if a fire starts? My husband heard that you have to pay whether you had anything to do with the fire or not, so we're carrying this big liability policy. So if you can enlighten me on that, I love your show.
Oh, thank you, Deanie. Thanks for calling, too.
Yeah.
So that's a good question, because I know that there's been talk about one of the major fires in Douglas County last year, Stout's fire, where the landowner is on the hook because he was out mowing in the middle of the day when it was specifically prohibited to do that kind of activity. Spark from the lawnmower starts the fire, on and on we go. Now, the situation that Deanie's talking about, though, what's the situation there as we know it about liability of landowner if they did not specifically start the fire themselves?
That's a great question for somebody other than me.
I was afraid of that.
Yeah. I know about as much as kind of what we've already talked about, if you are the direct cause of that fire, then you can be held liable for the entire cost of that fire. But usually that works out in arbitration between you and an army of lawyers on either side. But whether or not if the fire starts on your land but it wasn't caused by you, that I don't know if that might be a mitigating factor. I don't know. That would be a good question. I would be on the phone with Oregon Department of Forestry.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, well, maybe one of our friends from ODF is listening and wants to drop in a call here. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Becca in rural Lane County used the email address and wrote in, I took a great class in 2007, Living on the Land, put on by the OSU Extension Service Small Farms Program, East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District, and the Oregon Governor's Fund. It covered soil, water, pastures, wildlife, restoration, etc. Sounds a lot like the program your guests have. So Living on the Land sounds like Land Steward. Rachel, is there a similar strain of DNA there?
Yeah, I think that one is Living on there's a Living on the Land and Living on Your Land.
Uh-huh.
So the one that comes out of Nevada, that program is a little bit different. It was certainly inspirational for this, and it was tended to be a little bit more ag focused. I just was at a conference recently and saw a presentation by one of the founders of that program, and it's also a great program, but has a few differences and is a little more ag oriented, a little bit more towards small landowners, whereas our landowners go from, you know, 0.1 acre to 500 acres, and we address more kind of natural resource issues as well as some of the agriculture, but not so deeply into that.
Now, one of the bits of homework I understand for the Land Steward Program is they have to have a plan for what to do with their land. Is that right? Like, so in the example of 500 acres, for all 500 acres, or can they just say, let's deal with this part over here downhill from the stream?
Yeah, that's one of the really good things, is it really helps you think about kind of what you want to do. So really looking at your goals, that's part of the program, and then creating a plan. So each of those modules that I mentioned, there's a little bit of background reading that's online, and then we go out in the field with a natural resource expert, someone like Clint or someone from ODF or a riparian person who is going to talk about streams, and we do assessments. We teach people how to do kind of a basic assessment on, you know, during the class, and then they go home and look at it on their land. So then they put all those pieces together and they create their plan. And then that's really useful, even if it isn't exactly the kind of plan they need if they're going to go to Oregon Department of Forestry, for example. It kind of gives them the language and the understanding, and they have a lot of the pieces in place for working for funding or working with an agency.
So, Diane, after a couple of weeks of the Land Steward Program, when you took it 7 years ago, did you have fresh eyes by week one or week two and begin to look at your land differently yourself?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of a combination of things. There was the land steward program, and I don't know if by week two, I mean, by week two, I was probably thinking, wow, I really don't know very much at all, and then started filling in the blanks. I think that's most of it, is that you realize there's so much else to learn. And when I first moved to the property, I wasn't on it alone. And so, you know, in terms of throwing up some fences and throwing some sheep in there, it was like, you know, real basic, oh, you got livestock, you need to keep them on your property, right? Put up a fence. But it's amazing how much that infrastructure costs, and it's amazing how much money you can save if you have a better idea of where your gates are, if you're going to do managed intensive grazing, which is something I learned about several years later through a course offered through Soil and Water, which is a pasture management class, another really great resource for anybody who's managing pasture, either for lease or for their own animals. So, you know, at the beginning, it's easy to feel overwhelmed if a lot of the topics are new to you. But what's great about the program, it's incredibly supportive. When I went to it, it was PowerPoints in the auditorium every session with a few field trips. And now you're in the field pretty much every class, which is exciting.
All right. And then there's a bunch of homework, too, which I want to ask Rachel Werling about when we come back from break. We're on our way to that now. We're talking about the Land Steward Program, teaching people who move to the country and people who may be there already as well, how to better make use of their land and how to take better care of their land, how to be better land stewards, plain and simple. We're talking to Rachel Werling, Clint Nichols, and Diane Choplin. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and take more phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the Land Steward Program available through the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center based in Jackson County. It teaches people how to be good stewards of the land they own out in the country, whether they have just owned the land for generations or whether they're coming to it brand new, moving from the big city, as happened with one of our guests. Diane Choplin moved to the area from San Francisco about 7 years ago and was one of the first people to go through the Land Steward Program in Jackson County. Clint Nichols is with Jackson Soil and Water Conservation District. He's the rural planner there, and Rachel Werling is the overall land steward coordinator at SOREC. You may have questions or concerns of your own about your own land or about how the program is taught. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about the difference in the program. Diane pointed out that it was a lot of PowerPoints in the early days and now a lot more field work. There's a lot of homework, too, I noticed. I mean, people are expected to do a fair amount between the weekly sessions, it looks like, Rachel.
Don't scare them off. No, actually, it's a small amount of background reading. It's probably like 20 minutes of reading that is kind of introducing the concepts for whichever management topic we're talking about. Like if it's streams, you're reading about kind of what are the concepts with streams. And then actually, I mean, that is the thing that people just adore about this program is how much in the field. So on almost every class, we go to two different properties that are owned often by land stewards of graduates of the program, or in any case, they are stewards of land. So they're kind of demonstrating the topics that we're talking about. So it's not sitting in a chair and death by PowerPoint at all.
I didn't die, though. No. I survived.
You know, the other, well, there were a couple points I wanted to get to, but so then we asked them to do an assessment, and that helps them build their plan, which is really for them. That is going forward going to be a really great tool for them, whether they're looking for resources or whether they just want to think through, you know, if you make a plan, then you're more likely to get there. Yeah.
Some of the additional work, though, that I was talking about was there's a volunteering component here that is required as well. Tell us about that.
That's true. So we do have 20 hours, which is a really low bar for extension programs like Master Gardeners. They ask 70, I think. Woodland Manager is 80 or something like that. So it's a low bar. We do have a volunteer component. It allows us to do more as a program. For example, I think I was in here earlier in the year about the Living on Your Land conference, which is a one-day conference open to, you know, anyone who wants to come and has all kinds of things from making apple cider to thinning your forests, all these different classes. And so folks who partake in the program can help volunteer with that program. They can volunteer to help us host our classes. For example, this large predator class that's coming up, or we're going to have one on grasses and wildfire and management techniques. So you can volunteer to help with the program, but you can also volunteer to help with the Nature Conservancy if they're doing like seed collection or weed pulls, or Southern Oregon Land Conservancy. And what we find, I mean, first of all, it helps the program do more than one staff person could do. It also really increases your learning. It's more like a practicum. Like, we're thinking about changing the name of it to practicum hours, where you're going and you're getting more kind of hands-on field experience. And it also really helps to build the community. Like, with the team that gets together and helps us put on the conference, there are some friendships that are permanent that are made doing those processes. So there are all these really great benefits from that volunteer component. Even though occasionally we get pushback on it, you know, we're really committed to it.
I was reading about some of the friendships that have formed. Have you made some longtime friends through the program, Diane?
Yeah, actually, there are several folks from the first class that I'm still in contact with, and one of them is a pretty close neighbor, Kevin Talbert, whose name might sound familiar.
Oh, because... yeah, he ran for county commissioner
exactly.
in Jackson County 2 years ago.
And there were some times where I just felt so overwhelmed, and I had this tractor, you know, and they don't teach you how to drive a tractor in driver's ed, you know, and I knew the basics, but I had to clear out some irrigation ditches and stuff, and I just felt so overwhelmed, and I just called Kevin. I said, "Hey, Kevin, can you give me some advice?" He came over, and he demonstrated it, then I got on the tractor, and he watched me, and so, you know, just being able to call on people. There are other friendships I've made through other classes I've taken, too, as well, the pastor class, and so I've got great neighbors, and we take care of each other's properties, because when you have land, one of the hard things to do is to get away from your land sometimes, and especially if you have critters, you know, you need somebody to kind of watch over and take care of the critters, and all of a sudden you've got this group of people that you know have a similar base of knowledge as you, and you can call on them to kind of help support you, which is pretty amazing.
Has it been harder to take vacations over the last 7 years?
Well, not just because of land. There's the little goober in the
right,
element there, too, but he comes along to many of them. But yeah, it does make it a little bit harder to get away. And that's also one of the things that's really important to consider. I mean, Rachel's talking about putting together a plan. There's another, I'm going to plug another one. There's the Holistic Management International, or HMI, which also offers classes throughout. And that's also something that's supported through Soil and Water. And one of the things that they really talk about, I think, for their first entire session, at least when I took the class, is quality of life. They talk about that in the pastor class, too. It's the first class. You know, what do you want your life to look like? And if you want to be able to take a month vacation, that needs to figure into the plan of what you're doing on your property. So that's something that you don't think of. You know, we think, oh, we're going to do all these great things. And all of a sudden you have all these things you're supposed to manage. And you wonder how you're going to, you know, right. Go to Hawaii for a week or something, if that's something you can do.
It was a geologist who brought it up, but he was talking about the way in which you look at the land through a geologist's eyes. You look at, you know, where things drain and where the soil is and where the peaks are and all that sort of stuff. I wonder if you've got a little bit of that yourself now from having gone through the land steward program. If you look at a piece of property now, you see like, okay, I see the stream over there. I see where the pasture could be.
You're looking at aspect all the time. Yeah, and picking up the soil, seeing what it feels like, looking at the weeds, what's growing there, that's going to tell you a lot about what the condition of the soil is, for sure. I mean, many of us, especially after you go through the pasture class, you don't really consider yourself, you know, somebody who raises cattle or sheep. You're a grass farmer. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if you were really going to get down to it, you're kind of a soil farmer, because that's really the start of it all.
Soil steward.
Soil steward, there you go.
Okay, which is a great question to move on to Clint about, because it reminds me of some of the rotating of pasture land, it looks like. And it reminds me that we talked to Ken Salatin, is that his name, at Polyface Farm in Virginia?
Oh, Joel.
Joel Salatin, right. And he talks about how he rotates stuff through his farm. So, I mean, is that a major component of what you teach people about how to use different parts of their property differently at different times?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the pasture module in the land steward program, one of the first site visit that we go to is a landowner who is doing this managed intensive grazing that Diane had mentioned, where it's just about managing the rest that your pasture receives and how much more healthy and vigorous that grass will come back for your livestock. People tend to think if you put a bunch of animals in a tiny little area, you're just going to destroy your pasture, but it's actually not that way. And so that's one of the things that we try and open.
As long as you move them.
As long as you move them, yeah. It's all about rest and movement. So that's one of the things that's really kind of an eye-opener when we take a bunch of, you know, sort of new land stewards out to this pasture, and we see all these cows kind of smashed in this little pen, and then we open up that electric fence, and these cows literally jump for joy as they're moving to the next pasture. It's something to see, and I think it's a counterpoint to what we normally see, sort of the conventional systems of grazing that are out there. So it's opening lands, these, you know, budding land stewards into some different ways of how to manage land.
So I'm going to guess a few people probably say to you when you mention different types of soils, they look at you and say, wow, well, dirt's dirt, right? And I'm just curious to know the first sound you make after that gets said.
So I have a shirt that was given to me by a colleague that says, dirt is dead, soil is alive. So that's kind of the first thing I try and make people aware of, is that, you know, there is a difference between the two. But yeah, I mean, we have a broad mix of soils in this valley, and that can make a huge difference between the different crops that you can try and grow. All of that can be really determined by the different soils that you have. So,
now talk about water management too, because it looks like when I'm looking at the PowerPoint that comes from the Land Steward Program, that one of the things that people are a lot more aware of is their water usage, where water goes, where it comes from, all that sort of thing. I mean, have you got some real success stories about people who've really improved the way things moved across and through their land?
Yeah. So again, one of the biggest things that we talk about here in the valley is having people move away from flood irrigation systems. That's kind of the traditional irrigation system here in the valley. And it's, you know, it's inefficient. It's cheap as far as money is concerned, but it's very labor intensive. But so seeing those landowners move away from those systems to some sort of pressurized irrigation system, sprinklers, drip irrigation for vineyards, we see a lot of those going in. You know, using water more efficiently in all of those different sort of systems. That's a success for us.
Was flood irrigation just the easiest way to do it? You lift the gate, you flood the field.
It's all historical. I mean, this valley was plumbed for flood irrigation 100 years ago, and, you know, those systems are still in place. They're, you know, in, you know, better states of repair than others in some places, but that's what it is. And, you know, if you move into a property and you don't have an electric bill or maintenance bill for your irrigation system, that sounds like a bonus, but there's consequences to that, with tailwater coming back into a creek, carrying off whatever kind of soil and other fertilizers and whatnot you have on your field. So, and then just crop production, it's just not efficient, and it reduces your yield. So,
do you think flood irrigation is a major source of the so-called non-point pollution?
Yes,
into streams?
Absolutely. That, you know, if it's not managed correctly, that's the key. There are ways to do flood or surface irrigation so that you're mitigating that amount of potential impact to creeks and streams and that sort of thing. But again, traditionally, we don't see those kinds of techniques where they're managing that tailwater before it goes back into a stream. And so that's really what my district really focuses on, is getting those land practices improved.
Diane, was there a lot of blinking at first when you got into the program? And was there a site visit on your own property before you got into the training?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm not sure if there was a site visit with the land stewards before I took that class, but I think they do that now. They visit the properties of all the people who've enrolled in the class, which is really exciting. And each one of those opportunities is open to previous graduates of the program as well. So you might have former, you know, graduate alumni, I suppose you'd say, come to your property along with Rachel.
That is optional. We encourage that, mm-hmm. because the learning is just really great. Visiting
right.
and seeing things demonstrated on the land is really huge. But it's optional, but strongly encouraged
yeah.
to have that visit.
And then for Soil and Water's pasture class, that is something they do. And I think that it's really great, because even though you learn the broader concepts within the land steward class and some of these other classes, and it's very helpful for you to start to figure out what your priorities are, who you might contact next, having somebody like Clint, or if you take advantage of having a site visit before you sign up for the land steward class, come to your specific property and have an idea of what it is that you're battling, they're going to see things that you won't. Because, of course, if you're taking the class, you're taking it because there are a lot of gaps in the knowledge, right? So they're going to see things that you won't, that you might find would reorganize your priorities in terms of concerns. And that's really important, both for time management and also how much money you're putting into it and how wisely you're spending it.
You know, there's a permaculture principle of when you buy a piece of land or you move into a place, to not do anything for a year. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for folks to do that, but oftentimes when people come into the class, their eyes are just kind of spinning around. They feel so overwhelmed. How are they going to make this plan? They're really concerned that they have all these really huge problems, and we really try to encourage them to just wait and go through the program, and then they'll have kind of a better view of it and what to focus on. And actually, by the end, they feel a lot calmer.
So not change anything for a year or not do anything?
Well,
for
not
a year.
Not go, okay, this has to go and that has to be done and, you know, my fence is going here. So, you know, live for a year, see where the sun goes, see what, you know, what comes up in the spring, see what animals come through.
Where the water goes.
Where the water goes. What does that wet area actually look like in August? You know, all that kind of thing. Get a better picture of it.
You've already acknowledged, I think, that there are lots of other tie-ins to other programs that are offered through the Research and Extension Center. So I wonder if you have the Master Gardener, for example, come out there and the Master Recycler. I mean, is that all part of the
Well, you program? You could. We really connect people to that. I mean, I think also with the site visits, people can have them before. But again, if they wait, then they'll have seen a whole – they'll have been exposed to a whole bunch of these topics and people and resources afterwards. And I did want to encourage that. If you could just go to the Southern Oregon Research and Extension website and look at the catalog, there are lots of classes. Like we were talking about soils. We have a lot of good soils classes. We have another component of the Land Steward program with this community building is there's a mentor program. So folks that have graduated from the program, we have engineers and soil scientists and, you know, long-term land stewards, people like Diane. Diane actually teaches. She's taught us classes on photo monitoring, so really doing a good job of tracking what you're doing, which the funders love to see, and then they like to fund you again if you've done a good job on that. So there are just tons of resources. So go to the website, check out the catalog, gardening, small farms, our program, the forestry program. These all offer special classes. Sometimes they're one-offs.
It sounds like the program has evolved quite a bit since that first year.
Yeah. The heart has stayed the same in terms of these 11 classes, but the field-based and then the community-building pieces are a lot more extensive.
Diane Choplin, what would you say is the skill you're most proud of having learned in the Land Steward program?
Oh, that's tough. And not to say that I'm bragging, I have so many skills now.
But there are a bunch.
I'm always more aware of the gaps in my knowledge. That's just the way I function. And so for me, I would say that the biggest skill that I have, because I'm aware of those gaps in knowledge, is the ability to answer more specific questions that help me get to where I need to go.
Instead of just like, I think it might be this, you're able to say, no, here's why we don't
and,
do that.
And just really kind of building a community around certain issues. I am also a part of a group called the Rogue Pasture Managers that came out of the pasture class. So, yeah, that would be it.
The class starts in September, is that right?
It starts in September. Early bird registration for $50 off is August 9th. The deadline for registration is August 16th. Call SOREC 541-776-7371 to register.
And what's the total price of the class?
The early bird is $150 per person and $225 for a couple. So if you're co-land managers, and then if you're past the deadline for the early bird, then it's $200 per person and $275 for a couple.
We have learned a lot today. Rachel Werling is the Land Steward Coordinator at SOREC. Clint Nichols with the Jackson Soil and Water Conservation District. Diane Choplin is a Land Steward Program graduate. Thank you all for joining us today.